Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening. I'm Tassian Kwamalele.
And I'm Byron Wilkes.
Tonight on CNS News, we'll hear from a local family about a new study that's shedding light on autism, find out how residents react when BART runs all night, and meet the first black woman to lead a fire department in a major U.S. city.
But first, a March 5th protest against state budget cuts to higher education attracted thousands of supporters to Sacramento. Police arrested about 70 protesters who were occupying the inside of the Capitol Rotunda after the building had closed.
In Sacramento, students are making their voice heard.
We want it, and it's your duty to give it to us.
Protesting the state's $1 billion cuts from public universities for this year, students marched and rallied on the steps of the Capitol March 5th. Later that same day, California Highway Patrol officers arrested a small group of protesters who stayed inside the Capitol building after it had closed. The UC system's cuts come to more than $300 million. At UC Berkeley, many are dissatisfied with the shortfall.
I think they're basically cutting the future human capital of future societies. The reason why they do cut these, the reason why they do cut education is because of the fact they don't see the immediate value.
Absolutely stupid, to say the least, and immoral and all those dreadful things.
One of the things as a state we should be the most proud of is our public university system. And when we cut it, you know, we lose more than just a university system. We lose our future.
Currently, there are several proposals to increase funding to higher education. One of them, a proposed millionaire's tax. Another, a plan by Governor Jerry Brown. Until one of these is on the ballot for November, UC students will have to wait and see their future. For CNS News, I'm Byron Wilkes.
In November, a massive fire destroyed the 95-year-old Sequoia apartment building in Berkeley. Luckily, no one was hurt, but dozens of building residents lost their homes. Now, those people are searching for answers. Adam Grossberg has the story.
On the night of November 18th, dozens of residents returned home to find their apartment at the corner of Haste and Telegraph Avenue engulfed in flames. Human Cherokee was one of them.
Watched all the blazes busting out of our living room and our kitchen, and it was rough. It was, wouldn't want to go through it again.
Berkeley Fire Department called it the biggest fire in Berkeley in 20 years. 68 tenants lost their homes.
Everything we ever owned was pretty much there. We had a set of clothes on our backs, and that was it.
After the fire, Cherokee moved in with his roommate's family. The building was deemed structurally unsound and demolished over the next few weeks.
Not a single person was able to get anything out of there. So everything that was there is lost.
Over the last 5 years, tenants made numerous complaints about the conditions and safety of the building to the city and to Berkeley City Council member Chris Worthington.
There were tenants who had serious issues with fire safety, just general safety, toxic molds, you name it.
One letter from the Berkeley Fire Marshal to the owners of the building dated June 2009 said, "These are major fire life safety concerns that must not and cannot go unrecognized any further." In fact, Cherokee sued the building's landlord 5 years ago.
I plugged in my laptop into the wall, and it started sparking, and it caught on fire. The electrician said that there was a short in the circuit. They still didn't take responsibility, so what happened was I took him to small claims court. I won the judgment.
And even after he won his lawsuit, they still didn't fix the electrical wiring.
The Berkeley Fire Department's final report said the fire originated in the elevator room. When asked to comment, the building owner, Greg Ent, and his lawyer refused.
I mean, just some sense of what happened, you know? What do I do? I mean, I've lost everything. I have nowhere to go. What do I do?
With several lawsuits pending and lawyers and insurance companies arguing over blame, it may take a while for Human and other residents to get any answers. This is Adam Grossberg for CNS News.
Starting this fall, every school district in California, by law, would have had to offer transitional kindergarten, a state-funded pre-K program. But now that Jerry Brown has included it on the list of state cuts, thousands of families who were relying on that program may now be without a schooling option for their children. Kate Elston reports.
B, C, D, E, F, G.
4-year-old Eva is too young to enter kindergarten classes like this one in the fall. The cutoff birth date is November 1st.
Eva's birthday is November 2nd. She misses the cutoff date by about 12 hours.
No matter. Eva was going to enroll in a new 2-year program for children in her position. It's called Transitional Kindergarten.
It gives kids the gift of time. It gives them the opportunity to actually get ready to excel academically, socially, emotionally, physically in school.
But if the governor's cuts pass in July, Transitional Kindergarten will no longer be required by law. Districts can still offer the program if they choose, but San Francisco Unified opted out and slashed the program altogether just a day after Eva's mom turned in the application.
You're told to do one thing, you follow the rules, you hand in your application, and then now you're screwed.
Screwed because preschools and private schools are expensive and other programs are full. Most districts across the state, like Oakland, are offering the program.
Families really want a committed response, which is why Oakland's really pleased and proud that we can say to families, we are offering transitional kindergarten in the fall no matter what.
A San Francisco Unified spokeswoman told me the district had to cancel the program because the state has been so uncertain with education funding. But if Brown's cuts don't pass, the district will offer the program, but only at 2 schools. That's no help to Maria, who wants the program at her local school as promised.
We were getting kind of a no, 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 reasons why we can't do something.
No, 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 no.
So in February, a dozen parents from the 200 affected families went to the district headquarters. Together, they turned in waivers that would let their children enter kindergarten young. In the end, the district declined to accept those waivers. Parents say no one has yet to give them a solid alternative.
We kind of feel like the school district here kind of slipped the rug out from under us and threw us under the bus at the same time.
We just want our kids to have a good education, and so we're fighting for that chance for our kids.
Yeah, baby!
This is Kate Elston reporting for CNS News.
And now we take you to the world of roller derby, a time-honored Bay Area tradition, and the women who make it happen. It's Saturday night, and 1,000 roller derby fans have packed the Craneway Pavilion to see the Richmond Wrecking Bells take on the Oakland Outlaws.
I think it's pretty stiff competition. Oakland has a lot of really awesome skaters on that team. They have a very good competitive edge, and I think it's going to be a really good level of gameplay.
You may think roller derby is a new phenomenon, but 50 years ago, the Bay Bombers were wildly popular. Back then, roller derby was more entertainment than sport. Today, the rules have changed. The contact is real, and the women are edgier, with names like Katja Kockoff, Baron von Punchhausen, and Amanda Riott.
It's a sport that showcases strong women athletes. It's a great way to come out and be tough and athletic. You need a lot of endurance in order to play this sport, and it's just really great.
Despite the serious blows delivered by players and their apparent animosity, these teams are part of a tight-knit community. This is the Oakland warehouse where the 4 Bay Area teams scrimmage.
On Mondays and Tuesdays, we all practice together as a league, and so you become friends with people on all the opposing teams.
So, if Richmond's Wrecking Bells and Oakland's Outlaws are actually friends, is all the competitive hype, well, just hype?
I am all for the Bells, and that's all I'm going to think about, except for wiping the floor with some Oakland butt.
I do like kicking ass. The fact that I can push myself really hard past any point that I ever thought I could do physically, the camaraderie, the full contact sport, and everything that you get out of that.
And what did the Bells get out of Saturday's game? A sweeping 96-point lead victory. For CNS News, I'm Byron Wilkes. A recent study in California reveals new information about the causes of autism. Mariel Walloff tells the story of one family whose twin sons participated in the study.
Christopher and Gerald Dixon play together like most twin brothers. The boys look alike, dress similarly, and seem like any other set of twins. Except that Gerald is autistic and Christopher isn't.
I noticed that he had begun talking and then he just stopped talking.
And, you know, I said to Gerald Sr. one day, like, Gerald hasn't been talking. I said, have you noticed that? Christopher's kind of blabbering on and on and getting more words, but Gerald isn't really saying anything anymore, like, nothing.
Kristen had heard about autism because her mother was a nurse, and the fact that they were twins helped the family diagnose Gerald at just 2 years old.
And have the twins just side by side, you know, you have a comparison all the time. You see one flourishing and then one, like, floundering, which is why I think I caught it so early.
Researchers once thought that the primary cause of autism was genetics, but last year, the largest ever study of autism in twins found that genes account for 37% of cases, while the environment accounts for 55%. Christopher and Gerald were one of 1,100 twin pairs in a six-year-long study. Their parents say that the family has come a long way.
You know, another key ingredient to it is denial. Denial gets you nowhere. While I was in denial, she was embracing. Because for the longest, it's like, no, there's nothing wrong with my son. You know, the other one's just over-intelligent, you know, and this one's maybe just a little slow on the draw.
Gerald and the family meet with a behavioral therapist once a week. They're working on potty training Gerald, having him eat the same meals as the family, and teaching him to tie his shoes.
They still have their own little language and being without, what do you call that, telepathy, you know. Yeah. You know, they have their own bond, you know what I mean? So it's really there as normal kids would be. At the same time, Gerald has autism.
And he always will. But Gerald's parents say they see improvement, evidence that the support they give him is paying off. This is Marielle Walloff for CNS News.
Every fall, the Black Rock Desert in Nevada transforms into a temporary city. Last year, Burning Man, the part art, part wilderness survival event, was so popular it sold out for the first time. Julia Marshall looks at why this year's ticket lottery has some longtime burners really heated.
In January, devoted fans of the desert spectacle registered for a ticket lottery. Burning Man has become too popular, and the results weren't pretty. A good number of performers, theme camps, and mutant vehicle owners didn't make the cut.
It was devastating.
Emergency medical doctor Guy Shohat is part of a 30-person team called a theme camp. They serve free bourbon and bologna sandwiches. He entered the lottery hoping to get 2 tickets. What he got was a rejection letter.
It wasn't that a third of the camps out there didn't get tickets. It was that pretty much 100% of the camps got a third of their tickets.
Theme camps are communal spaces built by participants. They operate under the ideas of radical inclusion and no money changing hands. They are the interactive core of Burning Man.
We are minor. I think the serious people end up basically renting a warehouse.
Serious people like architect Bruce Tom. Owner of the mutant vehicle, Maria Del Camino.
It's repurposed from a hydraulic excavator. So all of the boom hydraulics and so forth have all been completely kind of Frankenstein to accommodate this new functionality of flying. Essentially, this is the full height up here. So it's a pretty nice way to fly in slow motion above the earth.
It's major projects like this mutant vehicle that make Burning Man so unique.
When half the people of the camp who ostensibly worked on this project don't get tickets, it's a problem. You know, on one hand, it's just unfortunate, but really, it takes the life out of everything.
Burning Man released a statement on their blog acknowledging the problem, saying the integrity of the event itself is at risk. Followed by an announcement that the remaining 10,000 tickets will not be sold on open sale, but redirected to some of the vital groups.
I mean, it's been very well received by the theme camps and by the people who want to see the theme camps there. But other people have said, you're being elitist, you're handpicking and choosing who the entertainment is, this isn't what it's supposed to be.
Chaos aside, one thing is clear, the show will go on. I'm Julia Marshall for CNS News.
Across the East Coast and the Midwest, customers are finding empty shelves where their favorite organic milk used to be. Reporter Melanie Ruiz visited California dairy farms to see if shortages may be coming to your grocery store.
Many organic dairy farmers are not making enough money to pay their bills. One of the reasons is that the price to purchase organic grain has gone up 30% in the past year.
The cost of the feed is just too high. You're going to be paying probably 70% of your income just to pay for the feed.
Dairyman Richard Hughes says he couldn't survive if he didn't grow his own organic feed. Organic dairy farmer Tony Azevedo is the president of the Western Organic Dairy Producers Alliance, which represents organic dairy farmers in the Northwest. In December, the alliance decided to take action.
And that's when we decided to send a letter to the 9 major processors in the West.
The letter warns dairy processors that unless they receive a raise, there will be fewer organic milk producers left in the business. The processors, who turn the raw milk into the dairy products we see in the stores, responded by giving the farmers an increase, but only half of the amount requested.
I'm very aware of everything that's happening in the industry.
Albert Strauss, CEO of Strauss Family Creamery, is a processor and a farmer.
I'm on the farm every day, and I see the issues. I live the issues.
Strauss meets monthly with the farmers who supply the creamery.
I went to them, said we need to do something.
One of the farmers he went to was Richard Hughes.
Well, we just got a small raise, so $400 a month doesn't go very far. It doesn't even buy 1 ton of grain for a day.
These efforts have come too late for some farmers, like one of Richard's friends.
He went so deep in debt that he had to sell his cows to pay the feed bill, all of his cows. And knowing how much he liked his cows and how much he liked the business, it's a shame. It's a shame.
Farmers and processors agree that keeping the organic milk industry sustainable will require basic change.
Consumers and retailers and processors need to understand what the challenges are and how to address it, and we need to unite as an industry to try to come up with solutions.
We're going through a hard time, and I think the rest of the country is too. We have to figure out what's important in life. I think food's kind of important, and keeping farmers in business that are really in tune with the environment, I think that should be high on the priority list.
I'm Melanie Ruiz for CNS News.
New city regulations are trying to keep the city greener. Alicia Avila explores the plastic bag ban in San Francisco and the changes it will cause.
It's a big step in the greening of San Francisco. The ordinance will ban what are called single-use bags, the thin bags you see in corner stores around the city. After the ban, businesses will be required to sell paper bags or biodegradable plastic bags in an effort to eliminate waste. In an eco-conscious city, most people think it's a good idea.
Charging a customer 15, 20 cents for said paper bag, whatever it cost, I think there's nothing wrong with it.
Yo pienso que está bien, si es por el bienestar de, para que no haya más basura y todo eso, está bien.
I think that's just one very small step towards reaching this goal that we, as a city, have placed upon ourselves.
San Francisco Supervisor Christina Olagi co-sponsored the new ban.
So I believe that the city has to be accountable to the goals that it sets. So in order to reach those goals, I believe we have to encourage different types of different lifestyle choices. One of the things that's really pretty minor is to ban the use of plastic bags.
But it's not going to be so simple. This is the kind of bag that will be banned. It's too thin, less than 2 mil or 2/1000th of an inch. And critics say there's a troubling lack of enforcement. Frank Wolf has been in the paper bag business for 40 years.
It's pretty hard to go around to all the retailers that are using these single-use bags and police them.
This regulation is part of San Francisco's no-waste goal, waste-free by 2020. But Wolf thinks the real solution is recycling.
I think the recycling program, recycling should be really looked at, really investigated, and really implemented.
Merchants have until October to change their bags or face fines of up to $500. This is Alicia Avila reporting for CNS News.
2 years ago, fewer than 4% of firefighters across the country were women, and just 6% were Black. Jeremiah Beckles looks at a big change in Oakland's fire department that could make a difference for women in jobs traditionally held by men.
Female firefighters often face stereotypes about their ability to do their job.
Yet they say they do the same job as male firefighters and go through the same training process.
We may not have the upper body strength that some of the men have, but it's amazing that the women in this department are able to find a way to get the same job done. So when people say, could you carry me out of a burning building? Maybe I couldn't. I could drag you out, but not every man in this department could carry you out either.
13% of Oakland's firefighters are women. That's more than three times the national average.
I'm not saying that that's enough. No, I think the department should continue to look at recruiting women and diversifying the workforce.
On March 5th, Teresa Reed became the first black woman to lead a major fire department in the country. At her previous job, she was known for not tolerating any form of harassment in the workplace.
I personally feel that we need to have true respect for each other. Someone's going to end up getting hurt, getting killed, because we are not able to work together as a team. That's what we do. We work together as a team. And a lot of times we can't pick and choose who those team members are going to be.
That's reassuring to firefighters who say skeptics in the communities they protect vary by gender, race, and economic standing.
African American women have been the most supportive. From men, I kind of, you know, am used to their skepticism. But women vary more. Women who have had to do things for themselves and not rely on men understand that, of course, women can do a job like this.
But they say there's a lot the community doesn't see.
More pressure. More pressure.
We spend a great amount of time together. We sleep in the firehouse. We're there 24 hours, sometimes 48, sometimes longer. So your crew ends up being, you know, your family away from home.
And that's the kind of cooperation the new fire chief wants to see across the board. In fact, she says she won't tolerate otherwise. I'm Jeremiah Beckles reporting for CNS News.
In another move to trim the state budget, adult day health care will be replaced by a new program. But exactly who has been found eligible in Alameda County has taken some by surprise. Casey Capacci reports.
Can I get everybody's attention? So a couple of you have already gotten this letter in the mail.
Senior patients at LifeLog Medical Care in East Oakland recently received letters from the state saying they no longer qualify for Medi-Cal subsidized adult day health care. The letter was a major disappointment to Darnell Lee.
Well, I was told that I wasn't eligible for the new place. If I don't get my exercise here, I have no other place to go. And so I'd really need to come here. It's a nice place to be.
A place which allows Darnell and patients who would otherwise be left alone at home to come to the center, where they receive treatment, counseling, and opportunities to socialize.
Adult day health care is one of Medi-Cal's largest general fund expenditures, but advocates say it saves the state money because it keeps frail patients stable and out of nursing homes and hospitals.
Centers like LifeLog faced drastic cuts in Governor Brown's budget until a settlement was reached between disability rights activists and the California Department of Healthcare Services.
I really felt like this is a great compromise that's really going to help us moving forward to reach the most vulnerable patients out there who really are at very high risk of institutional placement.
LifeLog and other centers in Alameda County expected almost all of their patients to qualify under the guidelines of the new program called Community-Based Adult Services, or CBAS. But many did not.
What's ended up happening is that far more of our patients have been declared ineligible than we ever thought possible.
There are one, two, three.
Social worker Angela Fazio-Landrum is working quickly to appeal the decisions that found 19 patients ineligible to receive care at the center.
We're the only program of our type, and without our program, I don't know what they think they're going to do unless they're just going to send a nurse out there every day, which I think would actually be more expensive.
Everybody in my family works. Won't nobody be home to help me out. Hope I find something like this, but I doubt it.
It's really disturbing and upsetting to see this service being taken away from them. It just seems to show like a real lack of regard and lack of respect for our elders.
Patients are currently waiting 60 to 90 days to hear back from their fair hearing process. In the meantime, centers like LifeLog are hopeful that their participants will still be able to come to a place many say has become a second home. I'm Casey Capacci for CNS News.
In an industrial corner of San Francisco, one man is experimenting with a biological alternative to lawnmowers and herbicides. Ryan Lachlan has the story.
Sandwiched in between railroad tracks and a cement factory in Hunters Point is a meadow that's home to some unlikely residents.
As, you know, places get more urbanized, people are thinking of more ways to take the edge off the urban environment. People are getting chickens, people are having community gardens, and we have goats.
But David Gavrich isn't an urban farmer. He runs the railroad for the Port of San Francisco and uses the goats to maintain vegetation around the tracks.
The normal routine for railroads is to come in and just saturate their yards with herbicides. We thought, let's find a different way.
So Gavrich started looking into goats as an eco-friendly alternative to pesticides and gas-powered machinery.
We bought 10 goats, and 10 begat 20, and 20 begat 40, and 40 begat 80, and then we started to do some serious family planning.
But how do you find a goat herder in San Francisco? Craigslist, of course, where Gavrich placed an ad asking for a goat herder who could also do some welding. The ad got 200 replies in a single day.
My name is Trevorton Rose, and I'm from Jamaica. I was unemployed. I was seeking for a job. Farming is in my blood, and I always have eyes out for anything within farming. Here I saw this ads was posted, so I said, okay, that's me, because I'm a goat herder and also I'm a welder, so I said, that job is for me.
Now Rose is living in a trailer on the property to be closer to the animals.
Absolutely. I love animal, and goat is one of my most favorite animal, because the goat is, first of all, they're sensitive and they're fun to deal with.
In addition to their government job, the goats sometimes freelance in other parts of the city.
We put out the word that we're willing to take them out to people's backyards that have overgrown. They'll spend a week out there. It'll be an absolute before and after situation where it was a jungle and now it's a groomed backyard because the goats have eaten down the blackberry, the fennel, the poison oak. And all the stuff the people didn't want, gone.
While it's uncertain whether the goats will replace lawnmowers throughout the city, Trevor Rose thinks that they could be here to stay.
These goats are so comfortable. They are city goats. They love it here.
In San Francisco, I'm Ryan Lachlan for CNS News.
When construction shut down the Bay Bridge over President's Day weekend, one Bay Area dream came true. 24-hour BART. Rachel Waltholtz takes us underground to find out what happens when the trains don't stop.
If you live in the Bay Area, there's one question you've probably asked at some point. Why on earth doesn't BART run past midnight?
We call it the pumpkin train because it's like Cinderella. If by 12 o'clock, it's going to turn into a pumpkin and you can't ride it no more.
11:30, gotta get to the train when all my friends are about to show up.
It's a cutoff. Like, people, like, disappear after, like, 11:30 because you got to get on BART.
Over President's Day weekend, Bay Area riders got their wish. Caltrans shut down westbound traffic on the Bay Bridge for 3 days, so BART ran all night long. The response was enthusiastic.
It's the dopest motherfucking transportation system.
It was the fifth busiest Saturday in BART's history. Between midnight and 8 a.m., over 9,000 people rode the trains.
So if the BART was open like this all the time,
would I be on it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. No. Oh, I wouldn't. Sorry.
Oh my God, dude.
It would be...
Everything would
be... a riot.
Perhaps not a riot, but certainly a scene. Many said they came out specifically because of the late night trains.
I just got done working a show at the Rocket Room on Clement Street. Everywhere around us it was packed. There's people out tonight because there's 24-hour access, there's 24-hour transportation.
So why can't it be like this all the time?
To run 24 hours, essentially, we would need to have another set of tracks.
That's because BART has to maintain the system. And with only one track in each direction, there's no way for the trains to keep running while the crews work. A second set of tracks would require other infrastructure.
Another transbay tube, another Berkeley Hills tunnel.
Allison says he doesn't expect to see it in his lifetime. So for Bay Area riders, a 24-hour transit system remains a distant dream. I'm Rachel Waldholtz with CNS News.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of CNS News. I'm Tatiana Kwamalele.
And I'm Byron Wilkes. We'll see you in a week.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.